Kia ora, you're with The House and I am Johnny Blades. At Parliament, some of the most interesting and unexpected debates occur on members' days, those alternate Wednesdays when the House debates bills put forward by backbenchers rather than ministers from the government. Here's a report from Phil Smith on this week's Members' Day, which threw up some surprising results.
Members' bills can be dull, but often they're not. Partly this is because, coming from across the parties, they bring a wider subject range and a broader scope of political philosophy. But also because some members' bills include ideas that most governments might be nervous to champion, or just not get round to. Wednesday this week was a members' day, with some good examples of all of the above, and some unexpected voting.
And all 15 of our MPs, unless anything crazy happens tonight, will be supporting this bill.
Chloe Swarbrick probably surprised National MP Stuart Smith during the second reading debate for his bill easing cellar door tasting rules. It isn't quite done yet, but it's finding pretty wide support. It's an example of a bill addressing a niche issue that might struggle to climb up a government agenda. Another small fix-it bill was Labour MP Greg O'Connor's bill on child sex offender overseas travel reporting, which had unanimous support. It adds more specificity to the current law. Greg O'Connor.
However, unlike such travel within New Zealand, the registered offender is currently not obliged to supply police with their intended addresses in the country they'll visit or whether there'll be children at the address.
But the other two bills were even more interesting. Green MP Tiana Tuiono's bill wants to reinstate New Zealand citizenship for some now quite elderly Samoans who had their citizenship removed by a law passed back in 1982.
The bill does not confer citizenship directly, but instead creates automatic eligibility to apply for and receive citizenship. It would not create new rights to citizenship for descendants of those whose citizenship were removed. As I said earlier, the youngest of these elders is now 75, Madam Speaker, and that is why it is important that now is the time for us to address these issues while they are still here.
Unusually, it was debated with a visiting delegation of Samoan MPs in attendance. Also unusually, it was agreed to by every party except the National Party. But that bill will still now go through to Select Committee for public feedback. Feedback which I suspect might be both fascinating and emotional. The most divergent debate, though, was over the very first bill. The bill that former Green Party co-leader James Shaw had delayed his retirement to speak on. It would add the right to a sustainable environment to the New Zealand Bill of Rights. James Shaw.
It appears to me that in the current moment, there is actually less political consensus on even the most basic environmental protections than there has been for most of my lifetime.
It is one of those bills that might make governments nervous. The current government were definitely against it. But it was also a bill with, for a members' bill at least, big implications. And it sparked debate over what it turned out were some quite gaping philosophical divides. ACT MP Mark Cameron.
This bill is actually an attempt to legislate for that same 1970s socks and sandal vision of a green world that has failed. It's failed when it's been tried in New Zealand. In the 1960s, 1970s, greenies like James Shaw believed that civilization would end because we'd run out of water, we'd run out of food, and we'd run out of energy. It turns out we didn't.
MPs disagree in big and small ways all the time about what's more or less important or prudent. But this debate felt a little bit more meta. National's Penny Simmons and New Zealand First's Tanya Unkevich.
We seek not to add burdensome red tape, but to strip it away, clearing the path so that we do get innovation and we do get prosperity.
The party is concerned that the inclusion of a right to a sustainable environment in the Bill of Rights Act may inadvertently restrict economic development, any opportunities, or even create a legal uncertainty that could deter investment and growth.
And it had that extra thing riding on it, being championed by a senior MP on their way out the door. So we'll give him the final word. James Shaw.
That my first female ancestor in New Zealand, Annie Matilda Baggett, was the granddaughter of a Jamaican plantation slave during a time when slavery was seen as a vital component of the global economy and the abolition of slavery was opposed as a threat to financial stability and economic development. People pollute the atmosphere. They destroy rivers and species and ecosystems for the very same reasons that they use slave labour or seize land that once belonged to a people that they considered to be inferior.
In the end, James Shaw did not get to see his final bill survive him. It was voted down. He will now bow out of politics with a valedictory speech planned for the very beginning of May.
Meanwhile, among the list of submitters for this week's select committee hearings at Parliament, the Auditor-General's office featured often. The Auditor-General is one of the three offices of Parliament, the three entities who have a particular job to hold the government to account. Its work provides Parliament with an independent view of how public organisations are operating, and there are a whole heap of them to keep an eye on. I sat down with Mark Evans, the Auditor-General's Director Sector Engagement Parliamentary Group, for a chat about their office's relationship with Parliament and began by asking him how wide its remit is.
Well, we often talk about the number of audited entities or the number of organisations that the Auditor-General audits, and that's every single public service entity. He appoints auditors to each of those across a range of audit service providers. So that we're about 4,000, and a good 2.5 of those or thereabouts are schools. So that's a very wide range from small entities like small crown entities, you know, schools, cemetery boards, to the very large departments like, you know, MBs and MPI and other departments and large crown entities. So across a large spectrum. And I'd quickly add to that, Johnny, not just the financial information, so the financial statements, assurance that the money's being spent as it should be, but also what's being achieved with that money. So how do we know if it's been spent as it was supposed to, but also what's the result?
So at any one time, the Auditor-General is conducting a number of reports and probing into, is this thing working well, is that thing working well, right?
Very much so. So there are performance audits. So that can be a team of people going in to really drill down into a specific area, which often we talk about in advance in our draft annual plan. And that will be our performance audit team going to, say, look at mental health or some other specific issue. And it could also be an inquiry. So when a member of the public, maybe a member of parliament, asks us to look into a specific issue for about the probity of a spend or an integrity issue. But then there's the regular contact between the select committee process and the scrutiny function that they have. So we've got a team of people who are in close contact with the select committees and often have a well-worn path between here and parliament.
This week, people from the Auditor-General's office are presenting at several different select committees. So how often does that sort of happen?
Well, for the annual review process, so that's when departments submit their annual report saying how the year has gone. We assist select committees to have a look at that that year that's gone and give them advice on lines of inquiry in confidence to the committee at the beginning, but eventually they become publicly available documents. So that we do over 100 briefs throughout the year on annual reviews alone at budget time. So we support the estimates, the scrutiny of the estimates, so where the money is going to go in the year ahead. And now, you know, we had changes in standing orders in 2023, which set in place a different approach, including scrutiny planning. So what's meant by that is select committees are now looking across the term of Parliament and saying, how can we best do our scrutiny function? Let's plan it. And that's a great step forward. So we're not having sort of as much day-by-day scrutiny, but more how do we know how well things are going over a period of time. And we are coming across this week to talk to select committees about how they might best implement those changes. So there's changes to the standing orders, which are, you know, available publicly and can be downloaded, describe a process where, A, there's a plan for scrutiny. There's more time, so we have things like scrutiny weeks, so where the House will sit less and there'll be more time for MPs to come into select committee and scrutinise performance at both estimates and also at annual review season. And so we are providing more information to support that process. We're seeing a lot more time spent on the issues that matter to those committees and the time available to committees to really drill down to what they think that matters.
Mark Evans, the Auditor-General's Director, Sector Engagement in the Parliamentary Group. Now, talking of scrutiny being applied to the government, many of us are familiar with the type that goes on during question time in Parliament's debating chamber. But sometimes MPs on both the government and opposition sides take a while to adjust to changing over. Here's Phil Smith again.
When the government changes, you might think that each party's refrain would also switch, that the once opposition, now government MPs, would suddenly go positive, singing of the new happy times. But that doesn't happen, at least not for a long while. So, for example, here's the Prime Minister in question time today, having been asked if the newly announced truancy policy had been approved by Cabinet yet.
Well, as I said, we have an ambitious government, and that is fantastic, because what we observed over the last 6 years was a government that spent more, borrowed more, taxed more, and delivered worse outcomes. You had six, the government, your government had 6 years, you did very little, you failed at it. What we're doing is declaring...
New governments can spend months, if not years, sticking to their oppositional refrain and attacking the previous crew. You might remember in 2017 when Labour took the reins just how often they repeated their 9 long years mantra in reference to their predecessors. As you might expect, the new National-led government have also held tightly onto their opposition mindset. The attack posing as an answer is a common approach in question time, but these responses are starting to try the patience of some MPs.
Mr. Speaker, almost every question that I've asked the Prime Minister today, he's resorted to an attack on the previous government without actually answering what are relatively direct questions on his government's current announcements and decisions.
More crucially, the attacks aren't just annoying the opposition, but the Speaker, who is the judge of all such things.
But I would also say to you that it is not inappropriate for ministers to refer to programs of a previous government. The difficulty comes where that reference becomes an attack, and I'd ask that all ministers, including the Prime Minister, think carefully about those comments in an answer.
No sooner had Gerry Brownlee gently chastised his colleagues for attacking the opposition than Nicola Willis was asked questions.
Funny that we have opposite us members who interject to ask us how long the statement was, as if the definition of success is how many pages you can put in your document. Well, here on this side of the House, Mr Speaker, that's not...
Don't talk while I am. Just go back to your answer.
Changing a rhetorical gears just does not seem that easy. Both Louise Upston and her National Party colleague Suze Redmayne, who was asking her Patsy questions, had to attempt handbrake turns.
I'm just going to ask the member to re-ask that question. It is effectively setting the battlefield for an attack, and it's not on. So ask in a different way.
Ask in a different way, did you say, Mr Speaker?
Well... this is a think on your feet moment, yeah. Just a minute, a question's being asked. Just wait till there's a bit of quiet.
How long are people predicted to spend on benefits?
Mr Speaker, the previous government's approach saw a substantial increase in the amount of time people were forecast to spend on welfare. People on the job seeker.
Sorry, take a seat. You can't start a question like that.
Chris Bishop remonstrated with the Speaker, saying that the ruling threatened to make Parliament so sterile we might as well not bother turning up. Gerry Brownlee.
I think it is possible to do exactly what you're saying without making an accusation of, for example, malfeasance. And I think it is that stepping point between talking about a situation you're dealing with and the outright attack on another party's policy.
There are probably many reasons why MPs do the knee-jerk attack thing, even outside the opposition. Most obviously, the attack mode can become ingrained. That attack can be an automatic response on an emotional level, and it can be an excellent deflective tool to avoid questions. But possibly most importantly, it's sometimes the only response there is. However impressive any new government may be, or however much positive impact they may ultimately have, it is usually years before there's anything useful to actually point at and say, I did that. Often governments have come and gone before you can even hope to see the most concrete outcomes. For example, next year, a new road will open over the Tararuas to replace the Manawatu Gorge Road. Now, that road was initially planned when Simon Bridges was the Minister of Transport, 8 years ago under National. It was being built throughout the two Labour terms and will finally open 2 changes of government later. And compared to social change, roads are fast. So, As I said, it takes a while to have many results to point at. But till then, you can always fall back on laying into the previous mob. Or now maybe you can't.
Thanks, Phil. And that wraps up our look at what went on at Parliament this week. Thanks for listening to The House, a program made possible with funding from Parliament's Office of the Clerk. Kia pai tō rā.